I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Hey, I'm Adam Carolla.
Hi, my name is Penn Jillette.
Not only listening, I'm the guest.
I'm a Penn and Teller, and I am the fourth listener.
And I am the fourth listener.
And that must make me at least the fourth listener.
To keep our three listeners coming back, we must be doing something right. And if you're the fourth listener, we thank you for the support. You can get every episode with no ads at patreon.com/DavidCSmalley and take advantage of your fourth listener status.
And we're going to sue David Smalley for slander.
With a world divided, it's time to resurrect nuance and remember the importance of conversation. He's an actor, he's a comedian, and he'll make you think. This is David C. Smalley.
Yes, it is. Welcome to the show. I'm really excited about this one. Michael, how are you?
I am well.
Once again, you were late today, so this hello is genuine.
Yeah.
I haven't spoken to you much.
No.
Sometimes we, you know, back when you first started and you cared.
Yeah.
About the podcast, right, and about joining me from time to time, it was, you were, you know,
yeah,
20 minutes early.
Yeah.
You had notes. You brought a pen.
Right.
Now yeah, you just show up unshaven.
Yeah. Right.
Sometimes drunk.
Oftentimes.
And then drunk. Just, give me a napkin, bro. I need to write something down.
Yeah, yeah.
And then do you have a highlighter and a crayon? And you're 20 minutes late.
It's, well, just, I used to enjoy your company.
Now I can tell.
It's get in and get out.
I can tell.
Minimize my time with David C. Smalley.
So as you were, settle an argument the guest and I had, because yeah, our guest,
oh,
today, we were already talking before you,
yeah,
got here,
yeah,
because we had plenty of time, because, yeah, I don't know if I mentioned you were late.
Yeah.
And we were trying to decide what made you late. He thought you were doing your hair.
Yeah, very good one.
I thought maybe you were saving a cow.
Right.
So which one, were you saving, well, the cow or doing your hair?
Well, as it turns out, we are doing a episode about the Mormons today. And,
oh, okay,
our guest, yeah, is a Mormon, mm-hmm, and the spirits of the Lamanites found, mm, out, and they slowed me down. I was attacked by spirit Lamanites.
Okay. Did it, something like that? It was just, were you just guys running around in circles?
We were. As you know, as Lamanites will.
Okay. Got it. So let's go ahead and bring the guest on, because I'm excited about this one, and it's probably going to last forever. So I want to jump straight in. He's a stand-up comedian.
Yep.
He's a friend of yours,
who, yep,
which is how we're even connected.
Absolutely.
But after I looked through his podcast, I'm surprised we haven't crossed paths yet.
Yeah.
Because the title of his podcast is Disorganized Religion.
Yeah.
Which sounds perfect. I'm sort of blurring those lines between, you know, the stand-up comedy world and religion. And I've been, you know, in the religious world for like 11 years. So like, and I'm looking at the guest, Chappelle Lacey, all these people are my friends. Chappelle Lacey, Dylan Sullivan, Jay Light. You were on there. Michael Ruggiero, Kelly Ryan, which I've spent hours with at the Comedy Store. And Jamie Kennedy, who, yeah, is a friend of mine and is actually, I think we're scheduled to record next week on this show, was just all on Disorganized Religion with our guest today. Please welcome Seth Lawrence to the podcast. Seth, how are you, man?
Hey, doing well. Thank you so much. I am honored to be here. Super thrilled. Can't wait. Can't wait for this discussion.
Yeah, yeah. So I was looking through. It seems like we have a lot of the same friends. So are you based here in LA? Or are you back in Mormontown, Utah?
Interesting. No, I'm in LA. Yeah,
oh, okay,
cool. North Glendale. Hmm.
That hotbed of Mormonism, North Glendale.
Yeah, that the second Zion, as, yeah, it were.
So Missouri and Glendale,
yeah,
California.
That's right.
Right.
They just kept moving,
yeah,
west.
Missouri, Salt Lake, Glendale. Yeah.
Nice. So you are a practicing Mormon and a stand-up comedian. So I guess the first thing, yeah, is all of your, I'm not familiar with your comedy. I apologize. I'm going to get that way. And I feel like I hope we're going to be able to be friends after this.
I hope so.
And I want to, you know, I want to keep you in the rotation here. I had a Mormon on not too long ago. I guess it was,
yeah,
episode 485 or something, 86. And he was like, you know, anytime I would come across something that he didn't know or didn't understand, he would go, I don't know about that. I have to look into it. Okay. I'd say, okay, make a note. He'd make a note and I'd say, we'll circle back and we'll do another show. And then at the end of it, he waited a couple of weeks and I reached out and said, hey, let's get you back on the schedule. And he's like, no, thank you. I'm not interested. I don't ever want to talk to you again. And I don't know why, like, I went back and listened to the show. I was like, I was never rude. We had a great time. We were friendly. And I don't know why that happened, but I'm curious. Yeah. I'm curious from the stand-up comedian perspective. Like, do you do all clean, like dry bar style comedy?
I try. I don't know that the topics I necessarily cover are dry bar friendly. But yeah, I try to be clean-ish. I mean, I don't swear on stage. I don't talk about sex in a gratuitous or graphic manner. But I don't know. Clean is such a broad word in comedy in particular that I don't want to mislead any listeners in making them think I'm working like a Christian comedy circuit, because I am not clean enough to do that. That's not where I find my humor.
I see.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly how to qualify my brand of clean. You know, I joke about religion a lot. And so... I don't know. I don't know how my people in dry bar comedy world will take it. I have yet to submit a video to them, but I've been gearing up to do so.
Wow, it sounds spot on. My one of my other friends, Erica Rhodes, who I'm sure you've come across or know at some level, she does all, you know, pretty clean comedy, and it works out really well for people who can do that, because you just have so many more opportunities. There are no comedy clubs saying do not do clean material, right? You're definitely welcome to do it, but you also have you're already ready for the, you know, all the late night TV, you're ready for sitcoms, you're ready for all of the conventions, you're ready for colleges, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's you're so much more well equipped to go mainstream when you have a clean set, you know.
Yeah, I like to think I'm already ready for late night, you know, ready to go.
You're Branson, Missouri ready.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I was talking.
Yeah, I think it's a different road, right? The clean comedy world. I liken it to the light and dark side of the force, you know? Hmm. It's sort of like you can hit pretty hard using the dark side, but it takes longer, but you can ultimately be more powerful in the light side.
I like that analogy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I'll admit, and I'm telling you right now to all the listeners, that Seth is a funny comic. I don't hang out with unfunny comics, and he's a friend and a great comic. He's
awesome.
Got my personal
seal
of approval.
Yeah, I look at those people and I'm kind of inspired to write cleaner material just for that reason, and also because I have so much respect for them for being able to be funny without that language, which is, it's harder. It's harder to be funny and clean. And, you know, before Yakov Smirnoff came on the show, we were hanging out at comedy clubs together, Yakov and I, and we started to become friends and hang out. And I was like, God, he's such a legend. Like, he's an absolute legend. And he was like asking for my advice on podcasting and wanted to know my opinions on Trump. And we were having legitimate, like, friendly discussions and even texting. And he would come up with an idea and text. And one day we would probably hang out our eighth or ninth time, and we were at a comedy club, and he saw my set finally, like a full, like, 20, 25 minutes. And I come off stage and he is laughing, doing that traditional Yakov. Yeah. That inhale or whatever the hell he does. I can't do it, but it's hilarious.
Yeah.
He did that. And I come sit next to him and he's like, you're hilarious. And I was like, hey man, look, I'm just going to shoot my shot. I'd love to open for you sometime. And he's like, oh, that will never happen.
Never, that will never happen.
Never in a million.
Your jokes are far too dirty. Yeah.
He was like, yeah, not in a million years. I love you, but absolutely not. We could never play together. He's like, my comedy shows are at 10 o'clock in the morning for people in their 60s. He's like, there's no way you could ever do that. I was like, yeah, you know what? You're right.
Yeah.
And at one of the shows I went with him, I think we were at Flappers, and the opener didn't even really curse. She just did kind of what I'm assuming Seth does, where he just kind of toes that line of inappropriate but never says the actual bad word. Mm-hmm. She was doing that, and I heard people in his audience groaning, like they were not happy with
geez.
Her.
Oh, boy.
Oh, she's making me think things I didn't want to think. Yeah, so I admire people who can do that. So Seth, my hat is already off to you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I look at comedy similar to, you know, like poetry or any other art, where if you confine it, some people don't like being confined, right? They don't like rules, and that is one beauty of comedy. I look at it as innovative, right? If you're given some limits, then you can be a bit more innovative with it.
Yeah,
I like that, Seth. And it's interesting with music. It's the same thing, you know. It's like I always give the example of like the band that hits it big, and suddenly they can have the London, you know, Symphony Orchestra on their record, and they can do all this stuff, and the record sucks. And it was just right. It was just them in a bedroom and an acoustic guitar. It was awesome, you know.
Right.
It's interesting when you give people limits, it forces them to be creative. They have to figure out the workarounds. Right. So that was a great analogy.
Yeah. So he's clearly brilliant. So let's find out.
So let's take him down a notch. Let's take him down five notches. My first question to Seth is it cool with the church that you're doing this? Like, is there some rule about exposing Mormon belief to criticism in a public way like we're about to do? Is there...
Right. Well, maybe that's why the former guest went dark on you. No, I don't think so. I have yet to write a letter to our first presidency. So, you know, I felt good about taking this, you know, this opportunity, this interview. And I guess I'll do kind of the same thing that the last member of the church did, which is to say, I'm not a spokesperson for the faith. I'm just going to be talking about what I understand, what I believe. And if people identify with it or disagree with it, then that's, you know, that's great. I think faith is a personal journey, and I'm here to share my thoughts on my faith, on my religion, as I understand it.
Yeah, anytime. So I used to have, when I had a house in Texas, I had a studio built into the home, and it was right next to the front door. It was really close. And I one time, in all the years I had the house and the studio, one time, these two Mormon kids knocked on the door, you know, missionaries, and they knocked on the door. I open it. I'm just like, oh yes. Like, this is what I've been waiting for. And they say, you know, they start talking to me about what they want to talk about. I go, yeah, come on in. And they go, great. And they walk in, and I walked them straight into the studio where there are mics set up. There were, you know, the walls are painted completely light blue. And there are these huge logos. Yeah. At the time, the show was called Dogma Debate. So it says Dogma Debate, like 4.5 foot, you know, stencils on the wall. And they see the microphones and they start backing out, going, oh, no, 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 we can't talk about it. Oh, no, no, no. I was like, well, come on, have a seat. We can record it and then you can listen to it. And they're like, no, 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 no. We're not allowed to do that. And I was like, oh, I just want to record, you know, for my safety and yours. And they're like, no, 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 no. And they just left. They wanted nothing to do with it. And they said they weren't allowed. Right. They weren't allowed to have any sort of public discussion, even though their jobs were to door knock. So that's a good first question by Michael. I'm wondering if that's any concern of yours.
No, it's not a personal concern of mine at this point. I think, you know, had I been a missionary, had you caught me, had Michael and I met at some bar doing open mics when I was a missionary, I would have had a lot to answer for, first of all. But second, you are called as a representative of the church as a missionary, so I can understand them balking at the at that conversation, or at least that format of the conversation. But no, I'm not concerned about this. Maybe I should be. But I'm not too worried about it.
No, because we're not really questioning. At least my goal today isn't really to question or to get some sort of a public statement about the church's stance on X, Y, or Z. It's more so, why do you believe what the church has put out? That's really my angle.
Right.
I'm like, because I think the church has a lot of evidence that they are wrong. I think they actually house the evidence of their own religion being incorrect. So I'm curious as to why you believe. So yeah, this is a personal discussion between us, you know.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So no, I'm not too concerned about it. As far as the church goes, I'm not concerned as far as the church goes. I think we'll be just fine.
So you're married with kids, I'm assuming?
Married with kids. Yeah, married with children.
How many?
The old TV show. How many? Three. We have three, with one on the way.
Wow. And how many wives?
Just one. Just one for now. Just one for now.
So I noticed in the form you filled out on the website, you put that women were equal to men. And that's one of the basic questions we ask, because you would be surprised at the number of people that say, absolutely not, men are the head of the household.
Sure.
But there are some documents, not only the Bible, but in Doctrines and Covenants and in, what's the Journal of, I'll get to that later. Anyway, it says that the Lord has assigned to men the chief responsibility for the governing and presiding over the affairs of the church and the family. And then, of course, the Melchizedek priesthood is only for males once they reach the age of 12, and women cannot reach that level of authority. So in the question, it says, should a woman have the same authority as a man? You said yes, yet it's a pretty core Mormon belief that men obtain a level of priesthood that women are not allowed to obtain. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, a few. So one quick clarification. Melchizedek priesthood is, there are sort of two in Mormon theology, two levels of priesthood. There's the Aaronic or the lesser priesthood. That's what boys get at age 12. Mm. And then at age 18, I believe it's 18, they get the Melchizedek priesthood.
Right, you're right. So can girls reach the Aaronic priesthood at 12?
Right, so no, they can't. Priesthood is a male, as far as I understand it, and there are some lines that are, I guess, kind of getting, not necessarily blurred, but I personally don't think that it has been very clear, because I'll just say this, that there have been some talks in General Conference that I don't want to lose people in my jargon, is I guess what I should say first. So we have a general presidency of the church. We have, you know, general authorities and apostles. They collectively speak to the worldwide membership every 6 months, and that's what we call a general conference. So at these meetings, there have been some talks that a lot of members, you know, we all view that as living scripture, right? Words of the prophets, where they talk about this distinction of men and women as it pertains to the priesthood. So the way I understand it is men hold the priesthood, women function within the priesthood, and to an extent hold it in the temple. But again, I'm kind of fuzzy on exactly how all that really plays out. What I understand is men hold the priesthood, as we talk about it colloquially, and women are able to function within it and use it in ordinances that they perform in our temples.
So if women can't reach a certain level of priesthood and men only can, does it sound like that you have a difference of opinion from the church, that the church believes men should have authority over women, and you think that authority should be equal?
So I'll say I think for people from, and even within the church, there is this thought that the priesthood, and my wife and I have argued about this so many times, that the priesthood and this authority.
By the way, next time record that, and I'll be happy to put it on the show.
Yeah, the so I can understand why people would view men holding the priesthood as having like authority or command over women, making women less. But the way that I understand the priesthood to work is not as an authoritarian regime. It is with counsel and working together with women. So, you know, when it affects where this dichotomy affects people the most is either in the house or in a local, you know, smaller congregation, right? Where women are dealing with men. And if men aren't listening to women, then I don't think they're really doing you know, what they should be under the priesthood, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. And I have to ask, Seth, because that sounds like a reimagining of something, and you're trying to put your modern perspective on older writings. Let me ask you this. Do you think if you gathered a group of elders in 1850 of the early church, that they any of them would hold the view that you hold on women?
Probably not. But I think if you found a group of just regular men, they would also not hold the same view.
Exactly. But you guys put this down as doctrine. And the people closest to the doctrine, closest to the original prophets, let's say even the original prophets, I don't know why we would have to go to one generation away. Let's go to Joseph Smith and, and his earliest prophets. If they wouldn't hold that view, where do you get the rationale for you holding the view?
I mean, I think there's definitely some cultural influence there, and maybe some better understanding of you know, gender roles or societal roles. But I guess, you know, the other side of this, as far as I view it, is that in my religion, gender is important. And I do personally believe that gender is important and that gender is eternal, that men and women have different functions. Physiologically, biologically, and potentially also spiritually, right? So, you know, it's not like women are better than men because they can bear children, and it's not like men are better than women because they have been, you know, given the priesthood. I guess is the best way that I can put it.
So that's an interesting point. Women have this unique ability and go through an immense amount of pain and struggle and suffering to bear a human out of their body. So it's a skill and an ability that they have and something they have to suffer through that gives them that special task. But men aren't doing anything to earn it. They were just told by God that they're extra special bosses. Like, and that's not the same thing, right? I mean, and men being given this thing, it's just because they are men, not because they have an ability to do something special. In fact, the very thought or the very concept that men have this priesthood and women can't, what that's suggesting is that men are inherently smarter or more capable of leading, because, you know, if there's going to be two people leading, surely it should be, it shouldn't be the one that's just has bigger muscles or thicker bones or, you know, happens to be able to lift more, you know, sacks of potatoes. It should be the person that can figure out problems, problem solve, and lead. And plenty of women are perfectly capable of doing that. Yet the priesthood ordained by God is that the man is in charge. And that's what I find so perplexing about this, that men didn't earn. It's not that we are provably smarter or anything like that, you know?
Right. And my thoughts on this is that the priesthood is not something we use for ourselves. It is meant to be used only in the service of others. So, you know, you can't give yourself a priesthood blessing. You can give others a priesthood blessing, but you can't give yourself one. And I think for me, it communicates more that men need to use the priesthood not as an authority sort of sword, but as a way to work on them being more caring, which I think is typically more inherent for women. And on the flip side, women, you know, in childbirth is one of the biggest feats of strength that we perform, that any human performs. And that is something that a woman performs, which I think is sort of counter to what we stereotypically think of as womanhood or femininity, right?
I don't know.
So in my mind, it's like these two attributes are given to us to help us understand and meet the other in the middle, if that makes sense. I mean, I definitely see how it's like, hey, men needed something to be better than women, so let's invent the priesthood.
Right, you know? And I get that. I mean, and anybody thinks that it, you know, I mean, that it's, you know, the man takes the pain and the strength and the woman, and no, anyone who thinks that honestly has never had their you know, their eyebrows done or had anything waxed.
Or their legs waxed.
Right, yeah. Oh, God. Yeah, there's no way. Right. As a matter of fact, my daughter, I joke with my daughter sometimes about going with her to have my eyebrows done, and she's like, she goes, you couldn't handle it. You're a weenie. There's no way. And I kind of believe her. Like, I kind of think I would walk out of there with one half done. Like, screw this, I'm done with it. But to me, it's a little bit like, you know, you get hired at a job and the CEO is clearly in charge of you, but your job is still important. You've got to take out the trash. You've got to, you know, clean the bathrooms. It's essential to business and happy customers. And the two of you are talking at a table and, you know, you say to him, I just want to be equal to you someday. And he goes, oh, we are equal. We just have very separate responsibilities. No, they are not equal. Yes, they have separate responsibilities, but they are clearly not equal. One person can tell the other person what to do. And, you know, the priesthood is also, which we didn't really talk about, is also essentially meaning direct contact with God, right? It's being in direct contact and receiving revelation. This suggests that women are not receiving revelation that men do, that only men do, and that men can receive revelation on how women should behave. And we'll get into that in a little bit when we get into polygamy, because I know some of that happened. Sure. It was this idea that, you know, I'm allowed to have multiple wives, and if you don't do it, God said he'll destroy you. And it's this very threatening, sort of under duress, you better do what I say, because God's in my ear and I'm in God's ear. And women don't really seem to have that benefit to talk directly. I mean, they could pray directly to God, but they're not receiving revelation, according to the Mormon faith, right?
No, I would say that's not true. I mean, the Mormon faith is a very personal one. So we all, men and women, are equal in their ability to receive revelation for themselves directly from God. That's never, as far as I understand it, never been a question.
For themselves only. But men can receive revelation for what women ought to be doing. And women should just believe that that man is telling her the truth about what she should be doing, correct?
Well, I think it's within context, and I suppose if you boiled it down and callously got to it, but you know, it's also like I am also beholden to those same men, right? So any man that's going to tell my wife what she needs to do also theoretically could tell me what I need to do. And you know, we all have the option of either doing it or not doing it. I guess the context is within callings within our faith. So within our faith, every calling, every responsibility within the church, other than, you know, the general authorities, is a unpaid and lay, what we call lay ministry. So people typically in my faith are not going to any sort of divinity school to understand how to teach a Sunday school lesson or to address the congregation. And we all rely on personal revelation to accomplish our responsibilities and make sure those that we have, you know, responsibility over in the sense of like we're teaching other people. If I'm teaching a class, I want to get revelation to help my fellow, you know, my students to feel the Spirit, right? And as you get into sort of leadership roles, callously, sure. The bishop, who is always a man, has the stewardship over the entire congregation and can approach the Relief Society president, who's always a woman, or a young women's president, who's always a woman, and say, I received this revelation for your organization, and you need to do this.
Right. Isn't that dangerous, though?
Yes, right? Yeah, it is dangerous when you have an imperfect people officiating in an imperfect church or organization. Yeah, that's dangerous. And there's been certainly, you know, abuses that have happened because of it. There have been people who have left the church over relationships because of it, you know, where the bishop and the primary president don't agree. But, you know, I think also there is some beauty there in when it's all exercised correctly. I don't think there is a time when a bishop truly correctly has gone to a primary president and said, you need to do X, Y, or Z, and the primary president just blindly follows. That's, I think, incorrect.
Okay. I would wonder, though, Seth, that this is all coming from the most perfect book ever written, that the by Joseph Smith's own words, that the Book of Mormon is coming from golden plates given to him directly from heaven. If I'm getting the story correct, please correct me if I don't.
Right.
That the whole idea of revelation seems counter to that. Does this mean God forgot to write some stuff down? He got something wrong and he needs to correct it. Joseph Smith got it wrong and it needs to be corrected. Where does revelation come in when somebody gave you the most perfect book ever written?
I think revelation means a lot of different things. So maybe let's get clear on what we're talking about with revelation. So, you know, when I say personal revelation, I'm also talking about like a personal witness or a personal testimony, a personal sort of contact with the Holy Spirit or with God or however you want to term it, with divinity, right? Revelation can be that. It can be sort of a vision, it can be a dream of something that you need to do or that people under your stewardship should do, I suppose. And then you have kind of the bigger revelations, which is like, you know, how Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon, seeing the, you know, the vision in the hat of the words that he needed to have written down. All of it is revelation. It's communication from God, which can be on a grand scale and on a very personal, minute scale.
Right. But
so I don't know if that answers your question.
Not really. I'm saying, what is the role? Well, let's forget the personal revelation for a moment, and the big revelations, and particularly the ones where the Mormon Church has gone, we got that wrong. Why is that? Why is it that very conveniently? Let's just start with a big one. We've been having a nice conversation. Let's get into some of the stuff that's a little more controversial. One of the big ones was the reversal of their. Of the role of African Americans in the church, of Black people in the church,
right.
Where it was once believed that they were cursed and they couldn't hold the priesthood. And then right around the time of the civil rights movement and the amendments and actual legal action that could be taken against the church.
It wasn't until 79.
Yeah.
1979.
79 that they said we were 100% wrong on all that. Now, is that the golden plates were wrong? Joseph Smith was wrong? The interpretation was wrong? How do you square that circle in your brain?
Yeah, I mean, as I understand it, actually, there were, you know, African-American members of the church in Joseph Smith's time who did hold the priesthood, and that is initially what got, you know, among a lot of other things, got the early members of the church in some trouble as they traveled west. And I think, as I understand it, societal, cultural pressure pressed the church to revoke the priesthood of African American members. I don't have any documentation for that, so I don't know that, you know, as far as historical fact. But I do know there were early members of the church who were Black who had the priesthood.
But what about the church teaching on the subject?
Well, the church got extra racist when Brigham Young came around.
Brigham Young is a I suppose a bit problematic of a figure. There were a lot of things that Brigham Young said and did that probably wouldn't fly today.
But was he getting divine revelation or was he full of it? I mean, this was claimed to be divine revelation. I mean, where does the teaching that Black people are paying a price for
it's in the Book of Mormon, I think. It talks about the closer you get to God, the lighter your skin becomes.
There are some verses like that. Very problematic.
In 1954, Joseph Fielding Smith said, there's a reason one is born with black and other disadvantages, and one is born white with great advantages. Those who were faithful in all things in heaven get greater blessings here, and those who were not faithful receive less. The Negro evidently is receiving the reward he merits. So that was a prominent church teaching, again, 1954, but it wasn't Brigham Young. It was a very common Mormon teaching that your dark skin was a punishment. In fact, some still call it the mark of Cain, right? And believe that he's, you know, possibly still walking the earth. I mean, and to go even further, some even say that that's Bigfoot sightings. Like, I'm not joking.
Right.
They say that that's him. Right. He took... a wife in the land of Nod, and which was basically just roaming the earth, And, yeah. that's the concept there, is that the black mark was a punishment.
Right, right. Yeah, that was, I don't know that the church ever officially, I know that there are some statements out there by some of the earlier prophets along that line of thinking. I don't think the church formally ever came out with that standing. And in fact, there was a professor at Brigham Young University, a religion professor, who did an interview where he essentially said that that was church policy and ended up being fired from his position and receiving a lot of church discipline for making that statement because it was incorrect.
But again, I have to say, that feels like a modern take. You're trying to force your modern ethics into an old doctrine. And if the actual prophets that wrote the book or interpreted the book or saw the golden plates would disagree with you, how do you rationalize that?
I guess I rationalize it in the sense that I don't think that it was a church doctrine that black people were or are cursed of God. And potentially we just have to agree to disagree on that point. But I don't believe that is or ever has been church doctrine. I understand that there are statements from earlier prophets to that effect. Mm-hmm. And this is what I think anytime you have a church led by imperfect people, which every church is, then you're going to get some errors along the way.
Doesn't the Book of Mormon in the versions before 70, it was 78, not 79, by the way, when blacks were granted
right.
the Melchizedek priesthood. But before that, I think the Book of Mormon I have is from 78. So I think mine still has the more racist stuff in it, but you're you're familiar with the phrase white and delightsome skin, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is part
I say that to myself every day. No, I don't.
No, but that's the as far as it being church teaching. I mean, it's in the Book of Mormon that
right.
that the lighter the skin, the closer you are to God, right?
Well, at least that I don't know if the white and delightsome skin is any longer in the Book of Mormon. But yeah, there are a handful of verses that talk about the fact that whiter or lighter skin is used as kind of a mark of righteousness. That's how there are a couple of verses I don't remember exactly where, but they allude to this sort of thinking that the lighter skin is a mark of righteousness. The darker skin is sort of a mark of a distinction. It's how God distinguished the righteous from the unrighteous at this time of the Nephites and the Lamanites in particular.
Yeah. So it was in Second Nephi chapter 5. It described a curse that God put on disbelieving Lamanites with a skin
right.
of blackness.
Right.
And then it said that the Lamanites were a dark, filthy, and loathsome people because of
yeah.
their unbelief.
Yeah.
So back to Michael's original question, that was in the original plates that you believe were translated by Joseph Smith. So God's racist?
No, I don't believe that God is racist. And I think, it could have been the inverse. It wasn't. And I don't know why it wasn't the inverse. And I don't know. There is this sort of obsession without all, throughout the standard works of separation of righteous and unrighteous. Right. And I don't know if it's more of a symbolism thing, not that darker skin is bad, but stereotypically we associate light and dark with, good and bad respectively,
right.
Not to say that people who have dark skin are bad, but I wonder if it's kind of an Old Testament-ish level of symbolism in physical.
No, not at all. I don't think so at all, because the people who wrote the Old Testament were of dark skin. Right, they didn't have
right.
that mindset. This is very much an Americanized, racist viewpoint that Joseph Smith wrote down, that Brigham Young put on steroids, and that many of the early church fathers put on steroids. David Patton, an early Mormon apostle, claimed to have an encounter with Cain that was also Bigfoot, who had the mark of punishment from God with black skin. It's got to be tough to be in your position. I mean, I wouldn't want to, you know, be in your position defending something like that. But again, my question is, you're obviously a good guy. You're obviously very nice. Every Mormon I've ever met is just about the sweetest human on planet Earth. So I don't think that you have any ill will or malice, but I am curious as to why such good people, you know, accept these types of writings to be from an actual prophet that came from an actual God, because it just doesn't make sense. It's very much centered around the racism of the time in which it was written.
Yeah, potentially so. I mean, we sincerely believe that these words, at least in their original form, and, you know, we could haggle back and forth about the role of translation, I suppose. But, you know, we believe that these words were actually written by descendants of Jews, you know, Lehi's family, which is where the Book of Mormon starts, come out of Jerusalem. So, you know, if you classify them as white, then I suppose there's some difference between them and the writers of the Old Testament. But I don't think there is. You know, they're all of the same ilk. They're all out of Jerusalem, right? So, you know, I don't know exactly that means necessarily that the Book of Mormon is a racist book, and I don't know why that distinction is there, but I don't think it has to do with race. I think it has more to do with, for whatever reason at the time, distinguishing the righteous and the unrighteous.
I guess the point is, if they had to update it in 1978, right, and make a change to make it not so racist, how did it end up there? Is your best guess that Joseph Smith made a mistake? Everything else he translated was actually on the plates and this was an accident? Or we are interpreting it wrong now. They didn't, when they said a skin of blackness was a dark, filthy, and loathsome people, that's somehow not racist.
Well, you know, I mean, truly, I don't know. And when, you know, I guess we should go back to the way the conversation about the Book of Mormon, you know, started in our conversation. You guys talked about it as the most perfect book, which is what Joseph Smith said about it. But I think it's important to distinguish the most perfect from perfect. And I think that still means there might be errors in this book, and that, you know, there are potentially some mistakes. But as far as, you know, the things that the Book of Mormon covers that are truly essential to what I believe as the gospel and what the church teaches as the gospel, race has nothing to do with our standing with God.
Right. So, but it comes down to credibility though, right? I mean, if, you know, I mean, it's just credibility. And let's move in now into Joseph Smith, because I think that's very important, because to me, it makes very much sense that he, you know, was making this stuff up, and he was a product of his own time, just like many of the, you know, forefathers of the United States. They were products of their own time. They did good things, but they also did very terrible things judged by today's standards. And Michael brought up in a recent show that we did together with Pastor Paul on his show that Michael believes that 100 years from now or 200 years from now, people will look back on those of us who eat meat as we look back today on people who own slaves and say, that's absolutely abhorrent. I would have never done that when I was there. And it's an interesting thought experiment. You know, it's an interesting thought experiment. But for Joseph Smith, these things that he did are just unbelievable because of his track record with fraud. And I know that you probably are aware of some of it, but in Bainbridge, New York, in March of 1826, he was only 21 years old. Joseph Smith was convicted of being what's called a disorderly person and imposter, according to the court documents. And he admitted in court to defrauding people by being a glass looker, claiming to have dark powers, including a magic seer stone. And this original document was discovered in a court building. I believe it was after a fire. And within 4 years of his conviction from defrauding people, he wrote the Book of Mormon and claimed to be translating these plates. And I just wanted to, before we go into more of his history, I wanted to get your take on that. Does that not raise alarm bells for you that there's really questionable stuff in there about dark skin and the roles of women and polygamy, and he had just defrauded people and got convicted of it and admitted to it in court and then created this religion and claimed to have these magic golden plates from heaven? Like, does that not raise alarm bells for you as far as skepticism goes?
I mean, not really. I mean, I guess as far as like skepticism or logic, I mean, yeah, sure. Yeah, of course. How can it not? But as far as my faith is concerned, no. You know, he was accused of fraud quite a few times in his days. But, you know, there were people who corroborated his story as far as the vision, his first vision goes, which he had as a teenager, which was years before this conviction in New York. And as I understand it, in New York at that time, a lot of people claimed to use seer stones or seeker sticks. I think that's the term for these magic treasure seeking sticks that they found.
Dowsers. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. And so it was fairly common for people at that time to believe in this kind of mysticism. And, you know, I mean, people believe in mysticism now, crystals and astrology. And, you know, I don't know that Joseph Smith necessarily intended to you know, do a lot of people harm with it. I think he admits to being mischievous and making some mistakes and being an imperfect person. I think there's a lot that Joseph Smith had to learn on his own personal journey. But do I think that means he fabricated the first vision, that he fabricated the gold plates and the story that is contained in the Book of Mormon? I don't think so.
Why? Where does his credibility come from, in your opinion, when he has a history of being mischievous and an imposter and lying to people and defrauding people and being convicted of in court? Where does the credibility come from that leads you to believe he had this magical experience?
I mean, it's a personal testimony that I have. You know, I read the Book of Mormon on my own for the first time all the way through when I was around 12 years old. And, you know, I'd been baptized at 8 and I was preparing to receive the priesthood at 12. I thought I probably should have read this whole book by the time I was 8, but I didn't. I should probably do that now. And I did before I turned 12. And, you know, I had a very personal moment in my bedroom praying about the truthfulness of the Book of Mormon and received a very, you know, strong testimony, witness that it was true, that it is true. And, you know, you can call that social engineering or, you know, kind of the happy-go-lucky, like feel goods of nostalgia of childhood, confirming truth that parents have brainwashed me with. But, you know, I don't think there's any way for religion, God, to be proven or disproven 100%. And I sort of think that's kind of part of the point.
Well, I mean, you know, it's not like there are tons of people in the Middle East or somewhere in Afghanistan who are also having personal revelation from Joseph Smith, right? I mean, it has very much to do where you're born, the year in which you're born and what your parents believe. And so that's way more important to determining your religion than what is actually true. And so,
yeah, at least so far, they're all going to get there. Don't worry.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure.
We're all going to get our own planet.
We're all going to get the planet, baby.
My issue with that sounded just like Michael Ruggiero. We're all going to get that planet, baby. I can tell you guys have hung out a lot. My issue with Joseph Smith is that he just kept doing it, though. Like the story of the Kinderhook plates. Have you heard of this? The Kinderhook plates?
I have not heard of the Kinderhook plates.
So feel free to take whatever notes you want. And I really hope this time, you know, you will come back after doing the research on the Kinderhook plates. Basically, this guy found these plates and presented them to Joseph Smith. And said that he found these ancient plates and he wanted Joseph to translate them. Joseph claimed that they were from a pharaoh and read them and
figured out what they were. Oh, is this where he translated them? And then the guy was like, I made it all up?
Yep. He made it up just to expose Joseph Smith for being a fraud. And the LDS church continued to claim that they were real and that the guy was lying. And so the church got so sick of it that they invited them to be inspected and scientifically tested. And in fact, it was confirmed that they were fake and from the 19th century. And and then that just the church still has the history of that. And still, as far as I know, has the plates and won't turn them over. But and admitted, acknowledged that the scientific evidence shows that they were fake, that Joseph Smith continued to lie about it. They continued to lie about it, found out they were wrong, and still claimed that Joseph Smith is a prophet. This was just him making an error as a human. And the problem is the same exact thing happened with the Book of Abraham. He claimed to translate this Book of Abraham, but it was later to be found out it was actually in his original handwriting, that he wrote it, and it showed handwritten notes on it, and it wasn't from Abraham at all, but it was some Egyptian incantation spells for an afterlife. He didn't write the incantation spells. He had handwritten notes on some incantation spells that were found, but he claimed to translate it and called it the Book of Abraham, and it had nothing to do with Abraham. That wasn't it at all. He was lying about translating the Book of Abraham, busted. He was lying about the Kinderhook plates, busted. He lied about the seer stones and was busted in court and convicted and admitted to being an imposter, but the Book of Mormon he was telling the truth about. That just seems like such a stretch to me to believe this guy.
Hold on, if I may just interject for 1 second. The invisible Book of Mormon he was telling the truth about. Or
the plates were golden.
Oh, they were golden. They were real. Nobody else could see though.
Right.
There's a testimony of 8 and a testimony of 3
witnesses
who saw the plates.
They never saw it though. They later all of them later admitted that they never saw the plates. They were behind a cloth.
Martin Harris
admitted that. A lot of them admitted that.
Yeah.
And in fact, I found this in my research on the last show, which I was shy. I learned literally that morning. I found an original picture of the actual original Book of Mormon that starts with the signatures. Because if you open this book,
they're all in Oliver Cowdery's handwriting.
They're all in Oliver Cowdery's handwriting. And he wrote their names as witnesses. So at some point, all of the men said publicly, and there's documented evidence that they claimed that they saw the plates. But then there is later evidence that they said, okay, we didn't see the plates with our eyes. We saw them with our hearts. We saw them with our spirits. The actual plates were covered with cloth. And remember, Martin Harris's wife was sick of Joseph Smith because Martin Harris was giving Joseph a bunch of money. And so 116 pages into translating this Book of Mormon, Martin Harris brings the papers home to show his wife what they're paying for, what they've been working on. She takes them and destroys them. They think she threw them in the fire. Some say she hid them. She's like, okay, well, I destroyed that. So if he's telling the truth, let him translate them again. He still has the plates.
They were never found, as I understand it.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Never found?
Right, that's what I'm saying. We don't know if she threw them away or if she burned them. But she's like, well, hey, if he's just translating plates, let him translate them again. This will be proof that he's actually doing it. And of course, Joseph could not recreate those 116 because he was pulling it out of his ass the whole time.
Now, David.
What is taught to us about the 116, there are a couple things that we could potentially come back to. But about the 116 pages is that you know, he records in the Doctrine and Covenants that he essentially has this vision that there are men lying in wait to prove him wrong. So they've altered the original 116.
Wait, what?
Yeah, so the claim is that the pages were not destroyed. They were given to some other group, and that they changed his original translation, and that if he were to translate them again, this group would come forward and say, we have his original translation. This is what we got from the Harris family. So, and it's different. These translations are different.
So this is like when Governor Abbott in Texas removed the mask mandate and reopened everything as the pandemic was ending, and then went on television the next day and said, all these illegal immigrants are bringing COVID into Texas, right? It's a pre-cover story for if they ever get busted, you know?
Right.
So now that he's opening everything, if COVID spikes, it's going to be because of the immigrants, not because people aren't wearing masks and social distancing any longer. That's what this is. This is the Mormon church getting out in front of themselves saying, in case anyone ever finds those original pages and it doesn't match the Book of Mormon, they've already been pre-edited and altered in Joseph's handwriting, no less, in case they're ever found. That to me is very clear that that's what they're doing.
Potentially so. I guess a lot of my stance on this will be I completely understand how people can come to that conclusion. That's just not the conclusion that I've come to.
But Seth, I know you, and I would find it hard to believe that any of these stories or excuses would hold water with you if it was about anything else.
That's a good point.
If you and I were at a comedy club, we walked out and a guy came out and said, I just was abducted by aliens and they took me to another planet and et cetera, fantastical story. And he said, and I wrote it all down, but if the story changes, it's because of this. And he has an advanced story and he goes, I have 8 witnesses. You would say, I need more than 8 dudes saying you're telling the truth, to believe you. Yeah. That's not good enough.
First of all, the guy wouldn't get that much out. As soon as he said, I just got abducted by aliens, Michael, you'd be asking him for weed.
Stop.
So
how dare you?
He wouldn't get that far.
We're in California in 2021. I would not take weed off of any stranger. I can buy it in any corner mart. Thank you very much. And for two, I'm saying that these stories would not be good enough for you, Seth, on any other subject other than this one.
Yeah, the one difference, I suppose, or to bring it to the same level, okay, if this guy also said, listen, Seth, you need to pray about it and receive a witness. And if you do, then you need to believe me. And if I did and received the witness, then probably
really?
They'd be
so if he said, I was abducted by aliens and that night you dreamed about it, you would say, Rogelio, I got news for you. I actually believe that dude from last night because of a dream I had.
Not necessarily a dream. No, a communication with the divine, Michael.
A communication with the divine.
Maybe it's in a dream. Maybe it's just a feeling, a speaking to my heart that convinces me. You know, I completely understand people looking at religion and being like, hey, the whole thing is a conspiracy theory, okay? And, you know, when people bring up contrary, quote-unquote, evidence, and it's like, well, that's they plan for that.
Unquotes off that. When
they come up with
contrary evidence, no quote-unquote needed there.
Quote-unquote facts, yeah. Blah.
Yeah, well, you know, I think if anything, we've learned in this political climate that there are your facts and there are my facts.
Oh, God, okay? Here we go.
I'm just saying, I totally understand. I totally understand why people come to that conclusion and why there are those who are skeptical of my outlook as a religious person. I totally get that.
Something that gives me pause, and it's kind of a curveball here, but we can look back at the things Brigham Young said and did, right? We look back at this guy. He literally said people inhabited the sun.
And the moon.
Right.
I thought Joseph Smith,
said people inhabited the moon.
Right, that's what I was getting at. So Brigham Young said people inhabited the sun, and he also said that Jesus appeared to him in the shape of a deer, and they walked around and talked for a while and hung out. He was incredibly racist. Joseph Smith said people lived on the moon. And yeah. According to the things he wrote in the Book of Mormon, while there may have been some black people who had the priesthood, it certainly seems that this skin of blackness and the dark, filthy, loathsome people, it sounded like Joseph Smith had a little racism going on there too. And then he defrauded people with the Kinderhook plates and defrauded people with the Book of Abraham and was an imposter in the Seer Stone and clearly lied to people and was convicted. It seems like God called upon a couple of racist morons to spread his word. I mean, these guys were terrible
Mormons.
People.
Did you mean to say Mormons?
Yeah, he meant to say Mormons. He meant to say some racist Mormons.
What I'm saying is there
have been... That's not much better
for
you,
What I'm saying is there has been a lot of good people in the world that God could have chosen to spread his word. Yeah. But these guys, you know, the church always says, well, when they're being jackasses, they're just humans making mistakes. We've all been a jackass at some point. Fine. Guilty. But anti-scientific racist making up stuff about people walking on the moon and living on the sun. These are the brilliant minds God came to and said, I want you to be my messenger of the Book of Mormon. That sounds like now God has issues selecting the right staff.
Sure, potentially
God has always
so.
Had those I issues. Mean, God always goes to very questionable people.
Yeah, yeah. All throughout the Old Testament, even arguably in the New Testament. I mean, what's he doing approaching Saul, for heaven's sake?
Right.
You know? Yeah, I can see that for sure. You know, I guess the inverse of the question is, you know, if this were all perfect, would you, Michael, and would you, David, believe it? If there were no refuting evidence, would you believe it?
So there's a difference between no refuting evidence and evidence that it's true.
Right,
so if,
right.
So if there were no
proven evidence that it's true, if someone came out with the gold plates, they translated, you know, exactly or very, very closely to what is printed now, would you believe it?
I would be more inclined to. I would definitely consider that good evidence for it being true, sure. And in fact, there are multiple things that could have gone a different way, right? So like if those Kinderhook plates had been true and Joseph Smith said this is Reformed Egyptian, or maybe I think he said that about the, I don't know if it's the book, no, I think it was the Abraham.
The Book of Mormon is Reformed Egyptian.
Right, which is no such thing, right? Which, there's no such thing as that. And there literally is no such thing as Reformed Egyptian. Joseph Smith made that up. But if he had said that and we later discovered there actually is a thing called Reformed Egyptian and we found the plates and it did say what he said they said, mind blown, absolutely. I go, okay, we need to look at this. This is legit. And I don't know that I would that day be a Mormon, but you would have way more of my attention than anyone else.
Some people on the moon wouldn't hurt.
Yeah.
That'd go a long way too.
Yeah, a couple of people.
We've had people on the moon.
Thousand-year-old. I know.
Yeah, not Quakers though. They weren't dressed like Quakers, like Joseph Smith said. But well, you know, even with the, I guess the issue would be, and I can't say, the only thing still holding me back from that, Seth, is that there are, according to Joseph Smith, if the plates were real, which I don't think they were, but if they were real, there were mistakes in them. Like there
Native
are
Americans.
The Native Americans were not descendants from the Israelites. They're just not. DNA test and linguistics both show that they came from that they're descendants from
Asia.
Asia, not Asia. Not from Israelites. So again, I would go, okay, maybe he has a plate that says something, but that plate isn't from God. And if that plate's from God, it's nothing that deserves my worship because he doesn't know the lineage of humans. Like, how could he possibly be any smarter or better or worthy of worship, right? And then the historical problems in there, as far as the elephants and the chariots and the goats and the steel and wheat and horses and all of the stuff that was not even in America at the time of the Book of Mormon, he claimed was. So that would have been wrong. So Joseph Smith made mistake after mistake after mistake. And there's even a verse, I believe, in 2 Nephi, where he's quoting something and it's got errors in it, and the errors identically match the errors in Isaiah 9:1 from a specific 1769 Bible that just so happened to be in the home of Joseph Smith at the time he, quote unquote, discovered the Book of Mormon. So he's literally copying things out of the Bible, including errors, and then claiming that that came from a special plate. But when you track it down and look at the mistake word for word, it's actually in Isaiah 9:1 and turned out to be an error. It's Bible scholars will look at that and say that was a mistake. It should not be that way. But it's in the Book of Mormon in 2 Nephi 19:1. So I would love to know how you wrap your head around these types of errors and issues when something that supposedly came from God.
Yeah. Have you looked at the gospel? There's something that the church has started doing, that my church has started doing, called the gospel topics essays. Have you heard of those?
No.
Or looked at those at all?
No, sounds interesting, though.
Yeah, very interesting. So, you know, you might classify these as more apologist approaches to things, potentially, but there is some good, valid research that's done. Mm. And
actually,
I mean, I can...
I do know that the church has some apologetics, and I talked about that with the other Mormon I had on the show. But I didn't. Yeah. I've never heard that phrase for the title. I didn't know that's what it. I didn't know that's what it was
these,
called.
Well, and to be fair, these are not like apologetics necessarily. They might read the same to you, but there are official statements from the church on various topics. They cover all the things that we've been talking about, right? The Book of Mormon and DNA studies is one essay. They talk about the Book of Mormon translation. They talk about, you know, Joseph Smith's teachings about the priesthood and women. They talk about Mother in Heaven. Anyhow, so there's a lot of very interesting research that the church has been publishing or summarizing on all of these topics. And I can send you guys the link if you're curious.
Yeah, that'd be great. Especially if you're going to come back on and talk about some of these things, like the Kinderhook plates and the Book of Abraham. I guess I don't know your stance on it, and I don't want to put you on the spot if you don't know anything about them. But assuming that what I've said is correct, and the errors are in the Bible, and the DNA analysis and the linguistics shows that he was wrong about Native Americans, and he was wrong about the Kinderhook plates, and he was wrong about the Book of Abraham— again, where does the credibility come from? Whenever you say personal revelation, and I don't mean this to be offensive, I don't use this word offensive, but I think that the personal revelation is a direct result of indoctrination. It has to be. That's, you know, when you're very, very young, between what they call the 414 window, you're so vulnerable to information, you know, that the stuff you learn in that very small window is so vital to how you view the rest of the world. And so despite all of the contrary evidence against Joseph Smith, proof that he was wrong about things, proof that he lied, proof that he made mistakes, proof that there are historical errors, you still say these magic plates came from God and Joseph Smith translated them. And I'm trying to figure out how you make that jump over all of his mistakes to this is the one thing he got right.
Yeah, and I mean, the honest answer, and I can get into some of the particulars, but, you know, the final and honest answer for me is that it is a personal relationship with the book itself and with God, with what I believe to be my testimony. And there's just no way that, you know, I can convince you of that truthfulness necessarily.
Can
right?
you share your test? Will you share your testimony with us?
Yeah. I mean, I believe that the Book of Mormon is of God. That is, that it was written by ancient prophets who inhabited the American continent. I do believe that Joseph Smith translated that book into what we now know as the Book of Mormon. I firmly believe that God exists, that He and Heavenly Mother exist, that they both love all of us, that they have created us and created this earth for us, and that if we follow the commandments, we can become just like them and live with them, live with our spouse in the celestial kingdom in eternity. Baby.
Okay.
So, yeah, well, I believe that wholeheartedly.
I think what David was asking was, what was your personal revelation when you prayed when you were 12? That,
like, why? Yeah. I guess why? I know that you believe all of that, and I feel like that answer you gave me would be what almost any Mormon would say when I say, what is your testimony? That's pretty straightforward textbook.
Yeah.
The question is, why? Like, normally, not to say you're not normal, but normally...
He's a little abnormal.
A little abnormal.
I'm abnormal.
He's very thoughtful, which makes him abnormal as far as... Never mind.
How dare you, sir?
Going after the Mormons.
It's a compliment. No, I was going after all of Christianity. Okay. That was totally... Yeah,
yeah. Way worse. Christian. I don't have a horse in that race.
I'll tell you what, the Mormon that I had on was like, in his form, he was like, most importantly, I want people to know we're Christians.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, they give us, like, they just don't think they're Christians.
Well, the evangelicals don't want you in the club.
Right.
Yeah, no, they don't. And to be honest, I'm fine not being in their club.
There we go. Something we can agree on.
I will say,
you don't want it.
If I had to pick who's nicer, just in public, I'm going to go with Mormons over evangelicals every day.
Yeah.
Right. We're racist within our own homes, baby, but we're nice out there. That's what you're getting at. I know.
Nice in public. Yeah.
I told you he was a funny guy. What overcame you when you were 12, when you read the Book of Mormon and you had a personal revelation?
Yeah, sorry. Let me finish that. Okay. So that's what I was getting at. Thanks for getting me back on task, Michael. So most normal Christians will say, you know, I believe this and this and this. And I'll go, but why? And they'll say, my testimony is... And there's typically a personal experience that happened. It was God came to me, or my mom died and I saw a vision, or there's some life-changing moment in which something happened to them that made them say, everything that I've thought about is true. And then I try to link those back to natural processes or whatever. So I get what you believe, but why do you believe it?
I mean, that experience when I was 12 was, you know, an overwhelming sense of love and of peace. And, you know, maybe it was all psychologically tied to my parents' approval and fitting in with Utah.
All right. That's good. Great show, guys. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. We figured it out. All right. Be sure to – no. Are you?
I'm
sorry.
Got something else to say.
I thought he was done. I thought he would.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He's still going.
Oh no, I was just gonna say that, you know, that you know, that is where it started. I do not think that it was just because of what was familiar to me growing up. I've had a lot of other experiences that have really shaped my relationship with my Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother. And interestingly enough, Michael Regilio is actually one of those experiences.
What?
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had been doing stand-up for about 6 months and had really gotten no traction. People didn't remember me. They didn't care about me because I was another white guy, okay? And I finally decided, you know, every time I was up on stage in that 6 months, I'd come off stage and feel like I'm not putting myself out there. And a big part of that was that I wasn't talking about my religion. I wasn't talking about my beliefs. Mm-hmm. So I decided, you know, I'm going to go out. I wrote down a set all about my faith and my religion. And, you know, I was like, I'm going to go to the Fourth Wall in North Hollywood and I'm going to do this set. And I'd seen Michael Regilio. I respected him deeply. I also knew, or at least judged him and his views on religion.
Yeah.
So I got into that room in North Hollywood, Fourth Wall, and there was Michael Regilio sitting there. And I said to myself, if Michael Regilio doesn't like it, I will know it's only because he's an atheist that he doesn't like it. But if he does like it, then I'm on to something. Okay?
So wait, so you weren't up, the problem? You weren't the problem either way.
Yeah, I was.
Yeah, you were definitely.
Well, What did you say?
No, I said, so you weren't going to be the problem either way. It wasn't the material Correct. At all. It was either my class broke.
That's the way I live my life.
Yeah, okay.
Never the issue.
Got it.
It's always the other. But, you know, I was super nervous. I was super nervous about this, about being that vulnerable up on stage. And went up, did my set. And Mike Ruggilio was one of the first people after that, Mike, to come up to me and say, you're really onto something if you keep this going, because there are not that many religious comedians that are funny without being like nauseating about religion.
Yeah.
So you should keep this up. And, you know, sure, you can say that's a coincidence. That's just the way that it was. But to me, it was a very personal answer to prayer.
Wow. Whoa. My mind is blown.
See, you walk up and lie to somebody and it changes their whole life.
No, I did not. I was dead serious, and I remain dead serious that what Seth is doing is really unique. I don't know of any Mormon comics, and at least not any Mormon comics who are Seth is not up there pushing the Mormon faith. He talks about his Mormon faith in an observational way that is funny, and he's a funny guy, and he's got funny observations. So I was dead serious then, but I got news for you. God did not come down from Kolob and inspire me to say that to you. That was just my atheist brain.
How would you know? Do you have evidence? Do you have evidence to prove that, Michael? How do you know you weren't inspired by God to say that to him?
But, you know, I mean, it's funny.
No, I'm serious. How do you know that God didn't make you do that? I'm going to put you on the spot here.
How do I know that God
You made a positive claim. I'm asking for evidence. You said God did not come down from Kolob. What is your evidence of that claim?
I don't have any. He may have come down. An invisible version of God may have come down, infused himself in my brain and my soul, and told me without telling me that it was God off of Kolob and inspired me to do that. That could have happened, It also could just have been that a guy who appreciates comedy liked your set. See, that's what I'm getting at, Seth, is Occam's razor. As much as I want to be your divine prophet, and I think there's a good argument for I should be that, whether or not there's a God, I should be your divine prophet, Seth. I think there's a real argument that I should be that too.
Whether or not you like it, you were the answer that night.
I love that, and I do love that, but it's Occam's razor comes into play here. You prayed and you say it could have been that I wanted to be loved by my parents, or it could have been that, you know, that it was just this warm, I got the warm feelies, because that's what you do when you meditate and you think about something larger than yourself. Occam's razor says, what's more likely, that you got the warm feelies when you were meditating and thinking about something larger than yourself, or that there's an invisible deity, he grated some golden plates, hit him in upstate New York, gave them to this guy, and you went with the really complicated as opposed to the really simple answer?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think he was lying to you. I think he genuinely said what he said. And the reason is because Michael has never, not ever, not once ever told me anything I was doing was working. Like he would just go back on stage, or, you know, go sit in the back and drink a beer. There was never, that's a great joke, or yeah, that's really working.
He's lying.
No, you've literally never said that to me. No, I just realized after hearing his testimony, I now realize you've never said anything I said was working. So that's fine. That's fine. But you know who did? My moment. I didn't pray about it beforehand. It was Jay Moore. Jay Moore, do you have the regular good set, good set, good set? We all do that. It's a polite thing. Jay Moore like grabbed my arm and pulled me back into the green room after he saw me come off stage. He looked me in my eyes and goes, "You're a great comedian, dude. You are really good." And I went, "Thanks." And then he started telling me my jokes back to me. And I was like, my God, he actually listened and paid attention. And I got chills. And then he went on stage and killed for, I guess, 6.5 hours is what I'm assuming how long he was on there. But that was life-changing for me. And I could, man, if I had been a religious person and prayed beforehand, right, like Seth did, and said, if someone tells me that I did a good job tonight, I know that this is my answer. There's no way you could change my mind. That a superstar like Jay Moore pulls me aside and says, "You're a great comedian." That moment has stuck with me and will stick with me forever. You know, so if I had prayed the day before or that night or that day, and then that would definitely feel like an answered prayer to me, you know? So I get it. Yeah. I get the power of it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, the Occam's razor thing is to me more indicative of just choice. That there has to be a choice. Mm-hmm. And Mormon theology is all about agency. So inevitably we have to make a choice. And, you know, why do I believe? Well, I choose. I choose to believe. It brings me happiness. It brings me peace. And so I continue to believe.
I don't think that's a choice you have.
Do you believe I'm predestined to do it?
No.
It's in my nature to do it. I have to do it.
No, I don't believe either of those. I think that a belief isn't something you can choose, but behaviors are. So I think... Uh-huh. I think you could hang up this call and go about your day and continue going to church. But if the real you deep inside your mind doesn't, if you actually go, wow, why would Joseph Smith lie about the Kinderhook plates? Why would Joseph Smith lie about the Book of Abraham? Why would he pretend this and then fraud people? And this one thing he just hasn't been caught in a lie because this 116 haven't been found. And what if? And then you start seeing other things and doing other research and you start seeing things that fall apart for you. You wouldn't be making a decision to not believe. And I don't think you're making a decision to believe despite this other stuff. I think it's more about behavior and vocabulary, right? I could, and I say this all the time on the show, I could go back to my old Baptist church and I could take the casserole and play the drums and be a part of the gospel choir. And I love that part of my life. I could go back into that in a heartbeat, but I wouldn't be living a genuine life. I wouldn't be making a decision to believe. I would be making a decision to pretend. Right. So I think just like in some of the analogies I use is, you know, go underwater at a swimming pool. Really close your eyes, concentrate, and try to choose to believe you're sitting up there dangling your feet in the water, and just take a breath. Whenever you believe it, take a breath. You can't fool yourself. You just can't. Another option would be to climb on top of the building that you're in right now. Walk over to the edge, close your eyes, choose to believe you're on the curb down by the street, and then just hop down to the street. Go ahead, just hop down. There's no way you can choose to do that. By the way, for attorney's sake, I'm not suggesting anyone actually do that. But that's the point, right? Is that you can't choose a belief. So I don't think you're choosing to believe. And that's why I'm so intrigued by you, Seth. You're clearly a smart guy. You're clearly very nice. And yet there's this very powerful thing in your life that logically doesn't make sense, and it comes down to a personal relationship with something that you can't prove. And so I'm just fascinated by you. I really am.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, thank you. You know, I think, you know, people, and I don't know if you're of the, I guess what I'll say is science also evolves, right? And so I don't quite understand why religion is expected to be perfect from the get-go if it's being communicated to us by imperfect people. Does that make sense?
Well, because science doesn't come through divine revelation. You'd think that the creator of the universe would get it right, particularly if he's putting it on golden plates. And science is just getting better all the time.
Yeah, but if those golden plates are being translated by an imperfect person... I mean, look,
what
Michael, you and I can
out.
Agree. He should have written it in English in the first place, right? But
or he should just show up once a week on TV and reiterate what he said.
I thought you were about to say TMZ for some reason.
Yeah,
I
don't know. God on TMZ pulls up in a Ferrari.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Bible tells us we can't look at God without dying. So then we'd all just be toast if he showed up on TV.
But the Bible's pretty hard to believe, too. I don't believe any of this stuff.
And besides, yeah. Kanye,
you know,
West has already
I
been on
think
TMZ.
There's room for, there is room for error. You know, we look at this life in my religion as a test, right? It's a test to see if... you know, to test ourselves, to prove ourselves, if we're going to remain true to God, if we're going to if we're going to choose to follow him. And with that test, there's going to be imperfections because we're in an imperfect world, and you can't completely prove or disprove God's existence.
Right. But I'm curious. So there's two things that I feel, and you tell me if I'm right or wrong, that with your acceptance of the Mormon faith, you get the in-group. You get the love of every Mormon. You get a support group. You get, your life becomes much easier, I imagine.
I'm assuming there's at least one Mormon that doesn't like him.
Right. There's got to be.
Got to be. Well, go ahead. Probably his wife.
Right. But I, my point is simply that you get a lot of benefit from believing by being in the in-group. It's a very supportive community. It's a very loving community.
Right.
And at the same time, I've been told, and I believe that there's a lot of evidence, that if you try and leave the Mormon church, do you not get a lot of pressure? Do you not get ostracized? Do you not get locked out of your family? There are people that will claim, I left the Mormon church and my family will not speak to me. My neighbors will not speak to me. Anyone that I was in the church with will not speak to me. Do you understand? Do you not think that there might be some pressures coming from both ways? That one side, believe, is a warm bubble bath. Don't believe is, you know, walking on coals.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've actually had quite a few friends of mine, leave the faith, and it is incredibly difficult. It's incredibly difficult for them to do so, emotionally, mentally, physically, very easy. They just walk out, you know?
Right.
But yeah, there's definitely we are tribal in our essence. Right, we want to belong. We're community creatures, and so there's definitely the pressure to stay in, the pressure to conform, and there's definitely the pressure once you leave to be ostracized. That you know,
have
fear
you ostracized
of the other...
anyone? You said you have friends that have left. Have you ever ostracized anyone?
I usually call them first and say, "I'm officially not talking to you anymore." No, I have not ostracized anybody. Yeah, no, I haven't. I actually had a long talk with one of my high school friends who left the faith. You know, we had a talk after he'd left the faith. And I mean, in all fairness, he was married, still going to church, but very public about his disbelief in the religion any longer. And, you know, there's a huge strain, right? I can't imagine how easy that's been on his wife, on their marriage. They're still married. They seem to be very happy together, which I'm overjoyed about. But yeah, it's difficult. It's incredibly difficult.
Have you seen, though, what are the mechanisms by which people are ostracized when they leave? Is there official doctrine saying that once you've left, you can't be part of this group anymore? Or is it just a social thing that once you're out, people are like, to heck with this guy or gal.
Right. I mean, it's more the social. There are some temple interview questions. I think there's one temple interview question. So when I say this, okay, so as members of the faith, in order to enter the temple, we have churches, normal church buildings. Anybody can go in there. But to go to like the fancy temple buildings, you have to have a temple recommend. And in order to get that recommend, that special access VIP card, you have to answer certain questions in a certain way, not like magic words, just you have to be honest. But, you know, there are clearly right and wrong answers to these questions. One of those questions is, do you associate or affiliate with any group that teaches things contrary to our doctrine? So arguably, if you leave the faith and if you are public about wanting to get others to leave the faith, I could see why there would be a more formal, like, hey, you shouldn't associate with this person. They started this group that is contrary to our church, and they're actually trying to get people to leave the church. But, you know, most people who leave the church aren't doing that, and they're just people trying to be happy in this life. And I don't see any reason to ostracize them for not finding happiness in this religion.
So what would you answer to that if you were to have to answer that question? How would you respond?
Oh, I've had to answer that question, and I have truthfully and without any remorse whatsoever said, I do not associate or affiliate with those groups.
Oh, because it's about the group, not an individual person.
Right. I mean, but, you know, if it were a person who were actively, like, trying to get me to leave, I suppose I'd have to tell them, listen, we can either hang out and you not talk about it, or, you know, I don't see the point of us hanging out anymore. You know, it's not like I'm trying to ostracize them. It's more like we can't get past this difference of opinion. And if that's the only thing you want to talk to me about and get me to abstain from or get rid of, you know, why would we do that to each other? There's no reason to do that.
Well, I think, I don't know, we could get into why. I get it. I know if you and I were hanging out, which I'm sure we will someday, hopefully we'll be doing comedy soon together.
I hope so.
My comedy store show should come back. I've got a monthly
Seth
show.
Seth was there. Always there. Seth was always at your comedy. Or not always, but a number of times
I
the show.
I came a couple times.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
How come I never met him?
That was great.
I think you may have been.
You had Sam Tripoli on, and he made fun of my laugh because I sound like an evil villain when I laugh.
Is that the one Bruce Buffer was at? Bruce Buffer was in the crowd from the UFC?
I don't know. I don't really follow UFC.
Oh, okay. So. Okay. I think Sam did it. I think Sam did twice. I was trying to figure out which one. Not that it matters. Well, I guess, I mean, yeah. I didn't realize. So did I meet him? Did I meet Seth?
I believe so. Seth, did I introduce you to David?
Yeah, I think we met very briefly.
I'm sorry, man. I didn't know that.
No, you're fine. I mean, you were getting ready to put on a show. That's like the most stressful time in a comic's life is producing and creating a show.
Right.
So
you're right about that.
I was not offended at all.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. So, well, anyway, whenever it comes back on, I'd love to have you. I got to tell you, when that kind of stuff, I mean, you know, if we're at the comedy store or we're hanging out anywhere else, this will be the last thing I want to talk about because this is what I do for a living. So you won't have to worry about that with me for damn sure. but I guess it's about how you interpret the word associate, right? So like, this is what I do on my podcast and I do stand-up comedy, and if we're friends, you know, to me, it's just like any church that's going to ask those sort of intrusive questions. Like, why does it matter? If Seth has a belief and Seth is going about his day worshiping and doing what he does as a Mormon or as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, then why does it matter if he's got a couple of atheist friends that he hangs out with and a quote unquote associates with who are actively trying to deconvert people from beliefs? I don't know. It just seems like an extra extension of control that maybe they shouldn't have, you know?
Yeah.
Well, maybe so. But I mean, if I were, you know, if we were to hang out and the only thing I wanted to talk to you guys about was my faith and how awesome it is and how you should join. I mean, sort of like, would you really want to be hanging out with me if I were like that?
No, but that just because you'd be annoying, not because some atheist leader told me that I couldn't.
Sure. But I'm just saying that I personally would also find it annoying to hang out with someone who is constantly like, hey, you know, you're following an idiot thing, you know?
Yeah.
I wouldn't need my church to ask me. I would just be like, hey, you know, like AA, right? Like you're not supposed to associate with people who are trying to get you to drink if you're trying to stop drinking.
Right. Hey, how much time do you have left with us? Because I've got some other stuff I wanted to talk to you about, but if you've only got like 10 minutes, I won't bother, but.
You know, I'm a stay-at-home dad, so this is such a nice break for me.
So you're good on time?
As long as you need. Yeah. I got more time.
Cool. So let's get into... So first of all, I want to give everyone your website, and then I want to get into heaven, because Michael dropped the term of the planet Kolob.
Right. I want to get into
heaven. And I want to get into heaven. That's funny. You had mentioned in your forum that you don't want people to think that people of faith are automatically hateful or anti-gay or any of that. Yeah. But, you know, the counter argument would be you sure are supporting a church that tried to stop gays from having equal marriage. I want to give you a chance to address that. And we have to talk about...
The big P.
Big P.
Polygamy. I don't know. That was just funny to me. Me and Michael had a moment there. And if we have time, I want to direct everyone to a whole list of more failures of Joseph Smith. There's a whole website dedicated to the failed prophecies of Joseph Smith and all the things he was wrong about when he claimed to be speaking for God, which further taps away at his credibility issues. But since this is the only time we're ever going to talk about Mormonism, I guess I should get it all out now, right? So,
yeah. Oh, boy.
Unless, of course, you ever want me to come on your podcast, which I'm sure it would come up.
Oh, yeah, I would love to do that. I would love to do that. My podcast is more about just understanding one another as opposed to, like, forcing you to defend a position, right?
Okay.
And I'm not saying like your format is bad. I'm just saying it's a little bit different in the sense of we're just trying to, you know, find common ground as opposed to like really delve into why what your justification is for.
Yeah.
But you know, with your episode, absolutely we can do that. That would be fascinating.
Yeah, I'm totally fine with being grilled about being an atheist too. I think that's fun. So
yeah,
we could definitely do that. Let's throw that on the schedule. That sounds like a blast. So let's do that. Before we do, it is I had the screen up and then I lost it. SethLawrenceComedy.com. And on Twitter, it's twitter.com/SethLawrence. Facebook, Seth Lawrence Comedy. And Instagram is only Seth Lawrence. Go follow him everywhere. You know, we're going to go talk about the rest of this stuff for the extended version of the show on patreon.com/DavidCSmalley. Come over there. Join us in the comments. And if you're not coming with us, please, at least drive like you know each other.